Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good Magazine. Why midlife might actually be awesome. From stronger relationships to deeper purpose, research finds that midlife may come with unexpected gains. By Shauna B. Tayon, June 30th, 2026. When I turned 40, I kept waiting for the narrative around middle age to catch up with me, the whole downhill from here thing. It never did. As I moved from my early to late 40s, one feeling resonated. I felt great. My smartest, most confident, and healthiest version of myself. The disconnect between what I was expecting to feel and what I actually felt was so large that at the end of the year, I started a Substack to talk about the notion that, yes, we can be happier in the middle. It turns out my hunch is beyond anecdotal and actually rooted in scientific research. Prime Time by Margie Lochman, the director of the Lifespan Lab at Brandeis University, suggests that we are looking at both life and especially life in the middle the wrong way. Instead of viewing life as one mountain to climb, the foundational perspective of the downhill metaphor, it's more accurately a series of mountains, and the middle, a pivotal summit where we get to look back at where we've been and make decisions about where we want to go next. Why do we believe in a midlife crisis? Based on over 30 years of research, Lochman roughly defines the middle as age 40 to 60, plus or minus 10 years. She demystifies the origin story of the midlife crisis, tracing it to an article in 1965 by a Canadian psychoanalyst who noted that the creativity of artists dipped in their mid to late 30s, which he linked to feelings of a looming end of life. We also have him to thank for the notion that life after 40 goes downhill. The idea of a midlife crisis was later fueled by a 2008 study showing a U-shaped curve to happiness, with it dipping in middle life. However, when Lochman and her colleagues investigated the data driving this study, they found that while visually compelling, the giant dip in the graph isn't as significant as it appears from the image. But the damage of a belief in a midlife dip in happiness had already been done. Add to that media uptake, and we have a full-blown cultural phenomenon that lives rent-free in most of our heads. However, research by Lochman and her colleagues shows that only 10 to 20% of adults report having a midlife crisis. More importantly, what's termed a crisis is closer to an introspective life challenge and one of many inflection points experienced throughout the lifespan, not just in midlife. Another challenge that amplifies concern about midlife is the belief that who we are is relatively stable by then in terms of our self-concept, or what we think of ourselves, and personality, how we show up in the world, both of which are key drivers to change. Self-concept and personality impact the realm of what we feel is possible for our lives, the goals we can achieve, lifestyle changes we believe we can make, and types of experiences we seek out. Lockman offers scientific research that counters the belief of a stable and immutable self. Specifically, 1, personality can change well into midlife and typically only begins to stabilize after the age of 50. And 2, the 50s is a pivotal decade marked by increased introspection and self-reflection. One of the great opportunities of midlife is that we are in a stronger position than ever before to close the gap between who we are and who we want to be. Using personality change as an avenue for improving the way you think, feel, and behave is a new and underutilized tool, she writes. We can have what she calls, in one section of the book, a midlife personality glow up. What do we lose and gain in midlife? A big challenge that I have with the popular midlife narrative is that it's a deficit-only narrative. We only hear about what we may potentially lose in this phase of life, and far less about what is available for us to gain or maintain. Primetime balances the scale in this area. The book covers various trade-offs in midlife, focusing on potential losses and gains. I'll share 3 such examples here. Cognition. A big concern many of us have, me included, is will I be able to maintain my intelligence and memory as I age or not? Lockman helps us to reframe this black and white way of thinking about cognition through the lifespan by reminding us that there are 2 components of intelligence: fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. Fluid intelligence is about quick thinking and innovation. Crystallized intelligence is the epitome of wisdom, which relies on experience, semantic memory, knowledge, and the ability to synthesize them all and apply it to the current problem. Yes, fluid intelligence may gradually decline as we age, but our crystallized intelligence gets better as we age through our 60s and 70s. This explains why I feel so confident now. It's the culmination of life experience, learned knowledge, and my ability to map it on to new situations, all things that we acquire with time. But if maintaining fluid intelligence is important to us, we are not powerless. Prioritizing activities that encourage neuroplasticity, like learning a new instrument or language, travel to a foreign country, or developing an artistic habit, can help us to preserve fluid intelligence as we age. Inflammation. In addition to our cognition, another area that gets a lot of attention around midlife decline is our physical health. Everyone from your doctor to well-meaning friends and partners is likely warning you about the potential uptick in illnesses as you age. These warnings not only are well-meaning, they can also be true. Research does support that as we age, we become susceptible to more physical health problems like cardiovascular, metabolic, and neurodegenerative issues. A major driver of age-related health decline is inflammation. Inflammation is our immune system's response to injury, infection, or harm. Lockman reminds us that a key driver of inflammation is chronic stress, something that many of us in the middle may experience due to managing childcare, work, and aging parents. Although we may not be able to control all of the stressors that we face at this stage of life, we can mitigate them through our mindset, social support, and healthy behaviors. For example, a study Lockman worked on using midlife in the United States survey data found that we can employ what she calls psychosocial anti-inflammatories, such as cultivating a sense of purpose and meaning in our lives, self-efficacy, which is believing that we can impact change in our lives, optimism, and positive social connections, as well as adopting a regular exercise routine, which has been found to benefit both our physical and mental health as we age. Combined psychosocial anti-inflammatories and exercise help reduce stress and the impact of stress-related inflammation. Social network. Many of us are likely to have a robust social network by the time we reach middle age, largely due to all of the roles that we hold during this period. Parent, partner, adult child, friend, boss, coworker, community member, etc. In support of this pattern, Lockman shares data from the Pew Research Center that shows 54% of Americans in their 40s are caring for both children and an aging parent. With our expanded network comes the potential for a rich and supportive tapestry of social support. But social networks can also add strain and stress stemming from the relationship. Our goal should be to minimize this to the extent possible and capitalize on social support aspects of relationships. Social support can reduce the impact of life stress and positively contribute to our overall well-being. An interesting turn that midlife presents for our connection to others is generativity. Research shows that one of the biggest gains we make in midlife is the realm of generativity, the way that we positively contribute to the world through care and concern for others, Lockman writes. For example, this might include volunteering, community activism, or mentoring. It's in this area that our lived experiences pay in dividends, not just for us, but for others. While the concept of generativity plays a premium on helping younger generations, this form of support can also be extended to peers and those older than you as well. A good example is an organization highlighted in the book, Seniors Helping Seniors, where older adults help other older adults across a variety of needs. The biggest takeaways from Prime Time are, first, that our mindset is one of our best assets as we age. It can determine the type of life we will live in midlife and beyond. Second, it's never too late to start making changes to positively impact our health and well-being. I'm living proof of that, having only recently regained a consistent physical fitness routine in the past couple of years, which has contributed to how good I feel right now with my 50s around the corner. We have the capacity to shape how our midlife years and beyond look through the right mindset, decisions, and support. We are not powerless. About the author, Shauna B. Tayon, PhD, also known as the Well-Being Doctor, is a writer, speaker, and trainer working in the area of well-being. Currently, Shauna is the owner of Well-Being Works, LLC, a boutique well-being firm bringing together the best interdisciplinary knowledge in the areas of social psychology, human resources, research, and training design. You're listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. How I practiced forgiveness when it hurt the most. When the compassion guy was killed, his sister was presented with the ultimate test of forgiveness and compassion. By Maria Bro, June 29, 2026. In April 2023, my brother, David Bro, popularly known as the Compassion Guy, in Davis, California, was stabbed to death as he slept on a bench in the town's Central Park. He'd earned that nickname after spending 14 years collecting definitions of the word compassion from passersby in a notebook or on video. This grew out of a personal awakening he had in 2009 when he gave away all of his possessions to devote his life to a higher purpose, one that included living without stable housing, approaching each day without expectation, and embracing simplicity and minimalism. It seemed a cruel irony that someone who lived and breathed peace and compassion lost his life in such a tragic way. I was devastated, to say the least. Even further, during the early days of my grieving process, I rediscovered a message David had sent me, one he felt he needed to write as he was becoming more of a public figure in Davis. If I am ever harmed or unable to speak for myself, forgive the perpetrator and help others forgive that person. Not long after, I found myself sitting in a courtroom, yards away from the young man who took David's life. How could I possibly live up to David's wish, this close, this personal, still deeply embedded in the grieving process? I had to try to practice forgiveness in real time. I kept coming back to the word practice. I knew I couldn't expect anyone else to feel the same way as me. This was my own journey. But there were others that I could learn from, people who had gone through incredibly difficult experiences, but still managed to somehow tap into a place of empathy and mercy. I studied the work of Holocaust survivor Eva Kaur, who forgave the people who killed her family. I listened to stories by Jack Kornfield, including his 12 Principles of Forgiveness. I learned from Fred Luskin that I had to be at peace with the vulnerability inherent in human life. There were lessons I absorbed, integrated, and put into practice. At first, it was easier said than done. But I had these examples and David's words to guide me. I also discovered things about the young man who killed David and found unexpected common ground in our life stories. It may sound ludicrous that someone would be open to identifying a common humanity with someone who's taken the life of a loved one, but that's exactly what I found myself doing during the course of the trial in May and June of 2025. Our mother had schizophrenia, so did the person who took David's life, Carlos Reales Domingos. However, Carlos had never been diagnosed as schizophrenic. That happened as a result of receiving a psychiatric evaluation during the trial. There's more. My mother was from Jamaica and Carlos was from El Salvador. We all shared immigrant roots. We all grew up in lower middle class families in dangerous neighborhoods. David, Carlos, and I had all been honor students. All of us, in our own ways, were survivors. We'd been accepted into college, with Carlos and me both being first-generation attendees. We'd overcome so much. It made me view Carlos not only through the same lens as David and me, but also that of the many kids that I'd grown up with, where domestic abuse, sexual abuse, food insecurity, and more accumulated into multiple adverse childhood experiences. These, in turn, can increase the likelihood of negative outcomes in adulthood. Not only did these shared stories deeply move me, I found myself noticing what it took to reach a place of openness to hearing them. It was, once again, practices, including active listening, granted, potentially inherent in a process that involves testimony and evidence, mindfulness, and deep self-reflection that helped me navigate pain and reckon not only with my humanity, but also with someone else's. I had to notice my emotions without judgment, recognize biases, and listen to not only testimony, but also the deeper context of suffering in general. It didn't interrupt the grieving process. That wasn't my goal anyway, and my therapist told me this wasn't particularly healthy. But what it did do is help me heal a little faster, grieve a little less, and empathize a lot more. We all play roles and bring our identities, biases, hurts, wants, and needs to painful situations. Because I was primed for it by David's request to forgive the perpetrator, by the work I'd done to learn more about how to practice forgiveness, and by my understanding of severe mental illness because of my mother, perhaps forgiveness came more easily to me. But I think anyone's capable, given time and space, to reach the same place of openness and empathy. It may not happen overnight, but the possibility, I believe, is there if one looks for it. The first trial for Carlos resulted in a hung jury. The retrial is now underway. I'm further along in my grieving process. I've even started partnering with transformative justice organizations that believe in fair chances for those who have committed crimes, as I believe. As civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson writes in his book, Just Mercy, each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I'm in a good place, still healing, finding purpose. Still, to take care of myself, I'm limiting my involvement with the trial this time around. Come what may, I'm going to be approaching everything with the resources I've gained and integrated, and with clear-eyed compassion. About the author, Maria Bro is a writer, filmmaker, marketing consultant, and transformative justice activist based in San Francisco. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming your way from Sun Sounds of Arizona next. And happy 4th of July and Independence Day.